Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a show about gardening, agriculture, and wild habitat. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. Since it is August and berry season, I wanted to talk to two local wineries, well, a winery and a meadery, that are utilizing local berries to make their wines. In this episode, we talk with Lewis Maurer of Bear Creek Winery and Jason Davis of Sweet Gale Meadworks and Cider House. Before we start this episode, I want to talk about the American physicist Richard Feynman. Arguably one of the greatest physicists of all time, he pioneered the field of quantum electrodynamics, which, to my understanding, is the study of how light interacts with matter at the very smallest levels. Feynman developed visual representations to simplify the mathematical complexities of how particles scatter in a high-energy collision. These Feynman diagrams helped him earn a Nobel Prize in Physics in 1965. As a physicist and a teacher, his genius was distilling complex theories into ways others could understand. He was also a character. He enjoyed playing the bongos. He would bring mathematical formulas and work on them in strip clubs. He played pranks on other physicists, tricking them into thinking the Soviet Union had stolen their formulas, and he was obsessed with Siberian throat singing. I wanted to read something from one of Richard Feynman's lectures. A poet once said, "The whole universe is in a glass of wine." We will probably never know in what sense he meant that, for poets do not write to be understood, but it is true that if we look at a glass of wine closely enough, we see the entire universe. There are the things of physics, the twisting liquid which evaporates depending on the wind and weather, the reflections in the glass, and our imagination adds the atoms. The glass is a distillation of the Earth's rocks, and in its composition, we can see the secrets of the universe's age and the evolution of stars. What strange array of chemicals are in the wine? How did they come to be? There are the ferments, the enzymes, the substrates, and the products. There in wine is found the great generalization. All life is fermentation. Nobody can discover the chemistry of wine without discovering, as did Louis Pasteur, the cause of much disease. How vivid is the claret, pressing its existence into the consciousness that watches it. If our small minds, for some convenience, divide this glass of wine, this universe, into parts, physics, biology, geology, astronomy, psychology, and so on. Remember that nature does not know it. So let us put it all back together, not forgetting ultimately what it is for. Let it give us one more final pleasure. Drink it up and forget about it all. That is from the Feynman Lectures on Physics, Volume 1, from 1964. Salud.
My name is Lewis Maurer. I am the owner and operator of Bear Creek Winery in Homer.
Bear Creek has been kind of an establishment for a while.
Yeah, it opened in 2003. Our lodging opened in 2003. Our tasting room opened in 2004.
How did you get into this business?
My in-laws started the winery back in 2003, and I was really interested in what they had going on. The business kept growing, so I would come up for vacations, Christmas holiday, things like that, and help them out. And as my wife and I, their daughter, were getting ready to move somewhere more permanently, we started talking with them about the possibility of me working with them full time. And there seemed to be a good fit there. And so we moved up in 2010, and I've been working here full time since then.
Did you have an interest in wine before?
I mean, yes, but I was a home brewer of beer, didn't make much wine. It's fun to create things. I have an interest in that for sure. So, but I didn't have much background or experience in it before starting up here with Bill and Dorothy.
So with Bear Creek, you know, you have the main winery and the tasting room, but you also have lodging and gardens as well.
Many facets of everything.
Could you talk a little bit about your gardens here?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the garden started as a way to augment the beauty of the winery. Dorothy was a home gardener and had flower beds around her home and around the winery. And as the business grew, it just made sense to expand and develop the grounds more. So we got to a point where we had staff members and hired somebody to do grounds maintenance. And it was a very organic, it's kind of a pun here, but evolution of the gardens has been very organic in that we happened to have somebody come on staff who was a landscaper, has a landscaping background, and he helped us develop the gardens into what they are now, did most of the install. His name's Tim Alzheimer, and he now runs his own landscaping business in Homer.
He actually has been on this program.
There you go.
He's been interviewed.
Yeah.
About berries.
So yeah, he's very knowledgeable. He's great to work with. So yeah, we started with our nature trail, and then evolved into our landscaped terraced lawns and the flagstone path and that kind of thing. So he was on staff doing maintenance for some time, and then now does maintenance as a contract.
What berries and what things do you grow in your garden here?
So we, as well as the ornamental plants, we had a focus when we were deciding what to plant in the gardens of what do we use to make wines. So we've got gooseberries, some golden raspberries, black currants, a few apple trees, two or three strawberry beds scattered around the grounds. So these are all things that we end up harvesting and then using in the wines. Also rhubarb, of course. It's been really fun. There are a lot of people that come into the tasting room and they're unfamiliar with some of the berries or the plants. You'd be surprised how many people visit from lower 48 that don't know what a rhubarb plant is. And this way they can go out into our gardens and see, you know, the actual plants, you know, growing and then what we end up using for the wines.
So a lot of the wines, I had a chance to look in the tasting room. I haven't tasted yet. That's after the interview.
Okay.
But I noticed some of the wines that you made I wasn't familiar with. So I wanted to ask you what a Carmenere.
Yes. Yeah.
What is that?
So that is a traditional red grape wine. So the grape wines that we make, we get grape juice or grape concentrate from a wholesaler, purchase that, bring it up, and then make those wines. We have less control over crafting those wines because the skins and the seeds have been removed, the clusters. what Bill spent 10 years doing as a hobby before starting the winery was making local grown fruit wines. And that's kind of our niche. That's kind of where our knowledge base is and where we focused our efforts. And we use the grape wines to augment and do blends with the fruit wines.
So one more that I was unfamiliar with, it was called an ice wine.
Yeah. So that's a style of wine. And you can actually do this with any fruit. There's been people that have started doing this with apples. It's a style of wine where you leave the fruit on the vine or the plant or the tree until a frost. So very late in the season. Typically, the fruit at this point is very ripe or overripe. Grapes can even be starting to raisin at this point. And harvest when it's cold, and then you crush and press, so you extract the juice out of the fruit right away while it's still frozen or partially frozen. And then you use that juice to make a wine. And so what you end up with is a much higher sugar content juice than you would typically if you harvested during a more normal time of the season. So the wine ends up being richer, concentrated flavors tend to develop, and higher in sweetness and higher in alcohol. So it's a style of crafting a wine.
So I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. So once the berries freeze, then the berries themselves start taking maybe their starches and converting it into sugar. Is that what is happening?
Yeah, sort of. So you end up with like tons of acid and starches in like a green unripe berry. And then as it ripens, it's converting both of those things, starches and acids, into sugars. And so the more ripe it is, the more sugar there is. And so by the time you wait until you have something on a vine that's way late in the season like that, and it's going to be highly converted to sugar. Yeah.
So besides the fruits that you source from your garden, what do you get elsewhere locally?
Like, what do we get that we don't grow here?
Yeah.
So outside of our gardens, we have an orchard quarter mile from the gardens, a different lot, close to where we do our production, and harvest those apples for wine production, as well as some of the local orchards around Homer we have a relationship with, and we'll go in and harvest their apples also.
I personally, at my farm, we grow grapes, and I don't know if there are many people in Homer that grow grapes, but I'm curious if you've ever tried sourcing local grapes.
I have not. More and more people seem to be doing grapes. I don't know if table grapes or otherwise. I know Bell's Nursery in Anchorage has an entire greenhouse dedicated to wine grapes. And he's called me a number of times for advice and things on sourcing yeast and what do I use and these kind of things. So he's getting to the point where he's making wines out of his grapes in Alaska.
We only have enough to make a 5-gallon batch every year.
Perfect.
So maybe I'll call you once we get another high tunnel or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And honestly, I mean, it's not that I wouldn't know what to do with grapes, but I would have a lot to learn because we haven't, my whole knowledge base is fruit. I don't have a background in grape winemaking, which is unusual in the industry. That's what most people do. So yeah, my background is blueberries and raspberries and things.
I would assume in Alaska, a lot of people, you know, they have to find these alternate methods. I just had an interview with the meadery, you know, and that was one of the things that he said is that having a source of sugar that was able to be locally sourced.
It can be it's a constant management all year round, all the time to maintain your network, grow your network. Yeah. And we are, I wouldn't call it a struggle. I mean, it's kind of part of the fun. We're constantly having to pay really close attention to what are we getting a lot of this year? What's not doing well this year? How are we going to market our wines to accommodate that? You know, all these kind of things. So sometimes we have total boom raspberry crops, and then we have a huge surplus of raspberries, and it's like, okay, what are we going to do now? So,
do your recipes change, or do you experiment ever with new fruits? Yes.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. We're still figuring out all kinds of things. Blends are a constant source of iteration. And then just recently, some of our newest, you know, forays into the unknown were we started doing a sparkling apple wine. We'd have a still apple wine, but now we're doing like a champagne style apple wine, which I think is lovely. It's seen some measured success in the tasting room. And then I've actually spent quite a bit of time a couple winters back developing some cider recipes, and I'm really excited. I actually have bottled some and released it, and it sold immediately, very quickly. And I've been waiting for equipment that's been delayed, heavily delayed because of shipping issues and because of the environment we're living in right now with everything to be able to, you know, do a larger batch of cider. I really like to, you know, do like a 100-gallon batch of cider and get it bottled. And yeah, I'm really excited about that.
Is there anything that you are interested in experimenting with, or any maybe like new trends in the wine world that you're right. looking to pursue?
Yeah. I mean, yes, but at the same time, we're so busy right now, it's hard to start new projects or take on new projects. But I've goofed around with salmon berries to pretty minimal success. Pumpkin wine, I've tried that too. We didn't continue with it because it just wasn't working for us.
Meaning it didn't sell?
We didn't even get to the point of marketing, of bottling some and putting in the tasting room. We made the wine, both of those actually, the salmon berry and the pumpkin wine, kind of had the same ending point, which was we prepped it and fermented a wine, and it didn't taste like much, either one. It didn't taste like salmon berries. It didn't taste like pumpkin. So we iterated a couple times on it and then kind of just moved on. You know, you gotta pick how you spend your time type of thing. So, yeah. And we were using local, the salmon berries were local, of course. And we tried pumpkins from the store the first time around. And then we actually tried baking pumpkins from Dave Shore. He gave us a couple to try out, and better results, but still not something that we thought would really work in the tasting room. So, yeah.
I love Dave Shore.
Yeah, he's one of the members of the community that we work with really closely in his orchard and take his apples. So
I noticed that Bear Creek has to employ a lot of people. I'm wondering if you could kind of give us an idea of how many people Bear Creek employs.
Sure. In the summertime, we have 15 plus employees. And then in the wintertime, we go down to about 10. So there's a number of seasonal people that come on in the summertime for the tasting room, and then also extra help in the gardens. That's kind of what we're made up of.
I know also that there are certain regulations for wineries, breweries. You have to only keep certain hours.
Yeah, I mean, just to briefly touch on the legalities of running alcohol-based business, yes, the laws are extensive and different in every state. There's laws that are at the federal level, and then each state has its own set of laws, and no two states are identical. Some are similar. And then licenses can be individual, too. For the winery license, we operate our tasting room from 11 to 6 every day of the week. And the winter, we're noon to 6, so Sunday's noon to 4.
And, you know, with these extensive gardens that you have, do you ever have events?
We do, yeah. I'm actually really excited about Pier 1 Theater is going to be doing some performances in the middle of August coming up here. So I'm really excited about that. I probably am not the best person to speak to it, but it's a mashup of Shakespeare plays. And I'm pretty excited that they're using the space and that we have the space. And so
I want to make sure that I talk about, you source a lot of your berries locally. Do you buy from individuals? And, you know, what is the going rate? If I was a farmer and had an excess of, you know, whatever, could you tell me about selling them to you?
Yeah. So people we work with to get berries is a wide range, from family groups, kids who want to make money during the summer, whatever, bringing in what they have growing in their backyard, to we work with some people that have high tunnels, or they're doing a fresh market, you know, Saturday market style deal where they bring in excess that they weren't able to sell retail, and then we'll purchase it at a wholesale price. And then we also work with more scaled up farmers. For example, there's somebody we work with in Palmer that has a blackcurrant farm, and we buy about 1,000 pounds of black currants from him a year. And the prices range quite a bit. The fruit, it's a commodity product, so as we have demand, we'll increase the price. And if we get overrun with particular kind of fruit, then we'll lower the price. And that's happened over the years. So right now, they vary from 75 cents a pound, excuse me, 60 cents a pound right now for chopped rhubarb, up to $4 a pound for blueberries. And then strawberries, raspberries, everything else, they fall in between there. So $3 a pound is actually a raspberry price. We got overrun with red raspberries, and I think we're $2.25 this summer. It's been $3 historically, so yeah.
When you were speaking about the community engagement that you're involved in, besides the Pier 1 production that's coming up, what are some things that you have done in the past as far as engaging the community?
Yeah. On the grounds here, we do, it's open to the public, free event. We do a Garden of Lights in the wintertime. So that's 4 evenings in December that we do. We put up a bunch of Christmas lights and people can come and socialize and enjoy the ambiance. And we also put on a music festival. I've done 3 of those now. And the intention is to do another one next summer to start doing those again. And that the proceeds that are generated from that event are given to the Homer Foundation.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Can you think of any interesting, fun tidbits about wine?
Oh, there are so many. Let's see. Some of the things I find really interesting about working with local fruit. So we make a red raspberry wine and a golden raspberry wine. I encourage people to come in and try them. Even if they're not for you, that's fine. But it's just fun to try them back to back because the two wines are crafted very similarly in that they have a similar residual sugar. The yeast that we use in them is the same. And I think it's really fun to then put those two wines next to each other and compare and contrast them and be like, oh, wow, like there are very distinct differences coming directly from the fruit, not from manipulation in the winemaking process. So things like that are fun to experience and try out.
I assume that they would be different colors. Is it comparable to a red and white wine in that way?
The contrast is not as large as a red and white grape wine, but yes, they are different colors. The golden raspberry is light, you know, light yellow, and the red raspberry is much lighter red than a red grape wine, but yeah.
When we visited the meadery, he was saying that, you know, his wines, his meads aren't shelf stable. Are your wines pretty shelf stable? Like if I bought some for a relative, could I send it to them for Christmas or something?
Yes, they are. A lot of that comes from, I know Jason at the Sweet Gale has a large emphasis on limiting any additives to his wine. And so that's part of the reason why that's a challenge for him is to have the shelf stable wines. So we end up using sulfites in our wines and that creates the shelf stability, the microbial resistance for that. The risk is that you have yeast. I mean, it's a perfectly healthy thing going on in there. It's impossible to filter out or have settle out 100% of the yeast cells. And so even if you have a, you know, sterile bottle and a very clean, careful bottling process, they just exist in the wine. And any amount of residual sugar that's still in the wine, even a very small amount, those yeast cells over time will eventually be active and find those sugars and consume them and produce CO2. And you can end up with producing enough CO2 to pressurize the vessel and you end up blowing the corks out of the bottle and things like that.
So sulfates not only are a preservative, but they inhibit the yeast.
The action of the yeast, yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just for people's general knowledge, sulfites are used throughout the entire food industry as a preservative. It's in a lot of salsas. It's in dried fruit. So
do you know what sulfites are actually made out of?
It's a metabisulfite is the longer term. It's a derivative of sulfur. And it inhibits the ability for the yeast cells to keep replicating and be active.
I know that some people in making wine, they'll add tannins, or some of the fruits they use will have tannins. Are there any other additives that you use with your wines?
There are a few things that we use to help clarify the wine. So like
bentonite.
Bentonite's one. Yep. So basically clay.
Mm-hmm.
That'll help. That will bind to solids that are in the wine, and then they'll drop out. They'll get heavier and drop out. Besides nutrients that we add, there's really not much else. But nutrients like biotin powder, or we might add some like chalk, basically like potassium carbonate to modify the pH or something. But yeah.
That is all of my questions. So I usually ask if there's anything I've left out or anything that you feel like needs to be addressed.
Yeah, the winery, we love operating the winery here in Homer. We love that there's so many people interested in agriculture. And as far as what we have going on specifically as it pertains to berry growing, we want to continue to promote that. So we like being able to use the berries as a value-added product into wine, and to be able to purchase from farmers, so that ultimately my vision someday would be that we'll have be able to have fruit that was grown within the state that we could get like in the grocery store type of thing, to be able to help out that industry.
Thank you so much. And that was Lewis Maurer from Bear Creek Winery, recorded July 29th, 2021. Coming up next, we talk with Jason Davis of Sweet Gale Meadworks and Cider House.
I'm Jason Davis. I'm the owner and the winemaker here at Sweet Gale Meadworks and Cider House.
I'm not sure if you're a comic book reader, but in comic books, the superhero always has an origin story. I'm wondering what your origin story is.
Oh, a quick version of my origin story. So I grew up in Soldotna, which is where I first discovered the berry that I'm in love with, the Nagoon berry. I graduated from high school there, went to college, got a degree in biology, and ended up, through happenstance, getting a job with this U.S. State Department and working at different embassies, mostly around the Mediterranean. In that business, you can take early retirement and get a pension. So a few years ago, I took early retirement from that line of work and retired back home here on the Kenai Peninsula. We decided on Homer rather than Soldotna, but it still feels like coming home. While I was living around the Mediterranean is where I learned to make wine. I had a neighbor in Malta who had organic Merlot grapes that he would sell me, and I would, this was about 12 years ago, I would make them into a natural wine, which is just a naturally fermented wine that has nothing in it but grape juice. And I was surprised how delicious and exciting it was. So I did that for several years in Malta, and then also in Sicily, where we spent some time, and a little bit in France. And then when we came back here to Homer, I thought I wouldn't be making wine anymore. But the house we bought had a lot of raspberries, like 100 pounds a year worth. So I researched how to make raspberry wine, and I learned that the main ingredient was white sugar, which didn't sound that appealing, but I figured I could use some of the honey from my bees instead of the sugar and make sort of a honey-based berry wine. And I fell in love with that, and it's delicious, and my neighbors loved it, and my friends loved it, my relatives loved it. So I decided last year to apply for a license to sell it commercially.
So the name of this meadery is Sweet Gale Meadery. What is the significance of Sweet Gale?
Sweet Gale is one of the names of a common bush or shrub that grows in boggy areas here in Alaska, and also it's circumpolar, so it also grows in Russia, Scandinavia, Canada. Here it's more commonly known as bog myrtle. That's what I knew it as growing up in Soldotna. I was always kind of fascinated with it. It has a wonderful peppery, spicy smell when you crush the leaves. And in the process of reading about how to make meads, I learned that the Vikings used to use that as one of the main ingredients of their meads. So it grows a lot around Lampert Lake and all around Homer, wherever it's boggy. So I experimented with it and I loved it. And so that was one of my main meads I was making. And when I was trying to settle on a name for the business, I thought I'd like the sound of it. And it's sort of one of my favorite meads. So that's how we ended up there.
So it's something that's found in wetlands or peatlands?
Peatlands, exactly. all around Lamprecht Lake, for example. It even grows out of Lamprecht Lake. It looks like, if you saw it, you would think it was a small willow bush or maybe a low bush blueberry that grows in a bog also, but it has that kind of grayish look to the leaf. But it, if you crush the leaves, it's very aromatic and it doesn't have berries or flowers or anything. It has little catkins. It's one of my favorite meads, started making even before I opened. There's a traditional way of flavoring both beers and meads where you use three ingredients from northern areas. One of them is sweet gale, bog myrtle. The other two are wormwood, which we usually call Alaska sage. It's a type of artemisia that grows here. And the third one is yarrow. And so I tried the three of those together, didn't really like it very much. So I separated it out and did three batches, one with yarrow, one with wormwood, and one with sweet gale. And it was the yarrow that was giving it the medicinal flavor that I didn't like. The wormwood was okay, but it was just very bitter without a lot of interesting flavor notes. But the sweet gale was really lovely and spicy and peppery, and I liked it a lot. So that's one of my mainstays. I think it's my second best-selling mead that I serve here at the meadery.
What's the first?
Blackcurrant. And in a way, blackcurrant is probably the reason I decided to open a business, because for the first couple of years, I was just making raspberry, and it's delicious, and it's nice, and it's pleasant, and even now, it's my go-to if I want a wine with dinner, because it's kind of neutral, it's probably the closest thing to a regular table wine. But a friend let me harvest some of her black currants, which is known as cassis in France, and so I thought it'd be interesting to try, and it really is so delicious and so interesting in the mouth. And it was it's by far the bestseller, and it's the one all of my friends responded to most strongly when I was offering it at holiday parties and stuff. Someone referred to it as a party in a glass because it's just so full of flavors and excitement. So it was that, I think, excitement about that particular mead that made me think, well, maybe I should see if people want to buy it.
I came here yesterday and I tried that, and it is so drinkable. It is so delicious.
Isn't it good? Yeah, I really love that one.
You had mentioned that you use local yeasts. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I use local everything, only local honey, only local berries and fruit, or herbs in the case of rhubarb and sweet gale, and pine tips, and flowers, I guess, with the wild roses. But in terms of the yeast, I do a wild fermentation, and probably in its truest sense, a wild fermentation would be also a spontaneous fermentation where you just dump in your juices and your honey and your berries and see what happens. I tried that and I noticed there were quite a few off flavors. So I do sort of a modified version of that where I cultivated over a couple of weeks a starter, basically like a sourdough starter, that became very fast and efficient at starting a quick, strong fermentation of my particular mix of honey and berries. And now that has been I've had that starter culture going for 4 years now. And with each of the different varieties that I serve, I just take a cup of last week's batch, because I do a batch every week to 10 days of every type. So I take a cup of last week's batch and put that into my 5-gallon brew pot as my starter. And it gets it fizzing really quickly and really actively. So all the yeast, it's probably more than just yeast. There's some researchers from UAF who came down and they took a bunch of samples and they're going to do DNA analysis of it. They're assuming that it's probably a whole microbial community kind of many different varieties of yeast and probably some lactobacteria as well, but they don't know yet. But it's a microbial community but it's yeast that are doing the job of fermenting the sugars in the honey into alcohol.
So when people talk about wine, they talk about a terroir. So it sounds like what you're doing is very pure kind of terroir.
I do kind of think of it that way. I mean, in the wine world, when they talk about terroir, they're really thinking mostly, I think, of the soil and the actual minerals that are in the soil. Maybe a little bit of if there's some salt around or something. But yeah. So I do see it as my goal as reflecting the terroir of here, but I think it's less to do with the soil and more to do with those yeast varieties and the plants that grow here. But I do imagine that a blackcurrant wine with currants grown here would taste a bit different than one that was grown elsewhere, but I don't have a firsthand experience with that.
On your website, I saw the term side-by-side fermentations.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure what that meant.
Well, you know, for the first 3 years that I made meads here, I would call them wines, but the first 3 years that I made those berry wines using honey and berries here, I was using the local wild fermentation that I talked about earlier. But when I was getting ready to go commercial, I thought I should try using a commercial yeast of the sort that is recommended for mead making and for berry mead making in particular. So I ordered a couple of different French champagne yeasts, and I made the exact same recipe of raspberry and blackcurrant wine using those commercial yeasts, and at the same time I used the same formula, but I used my yeast. And I was expecting that the commercial ones would come out a little bit better and more interesting in some way, but I wanted to see how much better, because I really preferred to be local, but I wanted to see how much I was missing by not doing it the correct way. And what I discovered when I did those two side-by-side fermentations is that the wild yeast was actually much, much, much better at capturing the full flavor and aroma of the berries. Like the raspberry wine made with the commercial yeast, it smelled kind of fruity. You know, there was a smell to it, but you wouldn't say, oh, those are raspberries. But with the wild yeast or the wild microbial community, it just pops as being like biting into a juicy, delicious raspberry. And I did it twice, and both times the wild one came out much better than the commercial one, which made me happy.
It sounds like a lot of the things you do might be seasonal.
Yep.
Is there anything that you are interested in experimenting with, or you kind of have your eye on for the future, flavor-wise, I guess?
Yeah. Well, this spring, I experimented with pine tips. Well, the first thing I did, actually, was a birch sap mead, where I did it two different ways. You know, there's this guy, Jake, who taps a bunch of thousands of, I think, hundreds of birch trees. So he gathers all this sap. It gets like 500 gallons a day from two different locations over the course of 10 days. So he has all this sap. And he sold me 10, gave me really, I haven't paid him for it yet, but he gave me 10 gallons of it, and I made 2 5-gallon batches of it just using the straight sap as my water source, because that sap is not very syrupy. You can hardly taste the sweetness of it. And it was a very successful mead. People liked it. It tasted just a little bit different than a straight mead, and it had a lot of nutrients in it for the yeast, so it got drier quicker than it would if I had just used regular water. But, so the other thing that was really much more interesting that he does, that I did, is that he runs his sap before he boils it for hours to get it concentrated down to like 1/100th of its original strength. He runs it through a reverse osmosis machine that takes it from 1% sugar to 6% sugar, and really concentrates the birch flavors that are in the sap without introducing any caramel flavors that you would normally get in birch syrup. So I got 20 gallons of that, or 10 gallons of that from him as well. And the mead that I made using fireweed honey and that concentrated birch sap was by far my fastest selling mead I've ever made. Like, a keg would never last more than 2 days. It would just, people would just go, if you, even now it's like 2-3 months later, people are coming in and saying, don't you have any of that birch sap? So that was really good. And then after that, I did pine tips, which were also really popular, really delicious. Spruce tips, yeah. I wasn't too excited about the idea of spruce tips because I didn't like the idea of a wine that tastes like spruce or pine. Like, they have that in Greece, and I don't like it. But with the spruce tips, when you get them very young and they're lime green colored and they're still soft and feathery, they taste much more citrusy than they do sprucey. And it really made a really fresh and delicious, like, lemon lime with a note of spruce in there that was really nice. And then the last one that was seasonal that I did this summer was with the wild roses. And I still have a little bit of that left, but I made 4 kegs of that using a pound of wild roses with fireweed honey, and that was very delicious also. Looking forward, I've tried nettles. I'm looking at some right here. I didn't like that too much. I think the main thing I'm interested in trying right now, I've made one bottle of it in my whole life. There's a berry we have called the Nagoon berry. It's a type of Arctic raspberry. It's here. The ones we have here are small, and each one has one berry. It doesn't fruit very reliably here on the Kenai Peninsula, but they have a version in Finland that is like their national passion, and they make a liqueur out of it. And so they grow it commercially there, and they have a cross between the type we have here on the Kenai Peninsula and their type, which is bigger and more aromatic. Here, smell how aromatic they are. I just picked a bunch of them. It's considered the most aromatic berry in the world. And it has such a wonderful, amazing smell, yeah. So I've made one bottle of wine out of Nagoon berries, because last year I got a cup that was just enough to make a bottle. It was by far the most delicious wine of any type, forget about berries, that I've ever tasted anywhere. So I'm thinking, I have 1,000 plants that I put in last year, and they're producing like crazy. I just harvested my, I guess my 12th pound of them. So I'm hoping to be able to make about 20 or 25 gallons of that this year. And I think it's going to be amazing.
When do you think that will be done so that I make sure to come to the meadery?
Well, I'm going to start kind of at my first batch, probably today or tomorrow. And then if I wanted to serve it a little bit sweet and sparkling, which I might, it would be ready. It could be ready within a month. But long term, I would probably make most of it into a drier type mead, which would take about 3 months to four. I mean, it'll be dry in a month, but then it's a little bit harsh when it first finishes. And it's better if I let it stabilize and settle and clarify for a few months before I serve it.
So you mentioned that you grow Nangoon berries in this garden that the meadery overlooks, that's right in the beside the meadery. What else do you have growing in that garden?
It's more of a test garden. I saw last year that there was something called a white currant, which I had never heard of. So I ordered a bunch of those and put them in, and they're about to produce their first crop. I'm hoping that they'll be aromatic the way that a black currant is. And I don't have a white wine that I love, so I was hoping that that would turn into it. I'm not so sure, looking at them, the way they grow, the flowers, the leaves, I had been thinking they were a black currant, a variety of black currant, which is always so aromatic, but I'm pretty sure they're a variety of red currant, like they're an albino version of a red currant. So red currants, in my experience, don't have a lot of aroma. They have a lovely taste when you bite into them, but they don't smell like much. So I'm afraid, I mean, I suspect that they won't be the solution to my search for a delicious white berry wine. And then I have, I put in some golden raspberries. At the time, I didn't know anyone who sold golden raspberries, so I wanted to see how they would do. And then I was going to try to talk someone to growing them. But then last fall, lots of people brought me golden raspberries, and I was able to make 25 gallons of it. And it was a really popular, delicious one. Not white, unfortunately, but close to it. It doesn't come out, it's kind of a yellowish tan color. So that's probably my closest thing to a white wine.
So you source a lot of the berries from the public?
Yeah, most of the berries I grow. I get 100 pounds of my own raspberries and maybe 20 pounds of my own Sitka strawberries, and everything else I buy from local farmers. I get a lot from Sean Jakinski in Anilchik, who I heard interviewed on your show a while back. There's quite a few people up on the ridge who have red raspberries, golden raspberries. I'm really looking for hascaps. There's a type of berry called a honeyberry or a hascap. I made one keg of that last year based on some that a guy gave me just to experiment with, and it was really, really delicious, so good. So I'm hoping to find a source of hascaps. There's some in Soldotna that they've promised me some, but I don't know how much. They don't know how much yet.
Are there any other berries that are sort of on your radar?
Well, so far at least, I can always use more Sitka strawberries. And normally with regular farmed berries like raspberries, regular strawberries, that sort of thing, I just try to pay a little bit more than Bear Creek, which is usually $4 or $5 a pound. But with the wild berries, I pay at least $10 a pound. I would happily pay $20 for Nangoon berries if anyone had any, but they're hard to find. And for the Sitka strawberries, I pay at least $12 a pound because they're a pain to pick, but they're really fragrant and delicious. So a lady brought in 30 pounds the other day, and I think I only need 100 pounds to get me through the year. So I think that'll be good.
So we used to have a meadery here in Homer, Ring of Fire
yeah.
Meadery. I'm wondering if there are other meaderies in the state or anyone else that's doing something similar that you know of.
You know, a guy came in who was one of the owners of Denali Brewing and was tasting my meads and wondering how I got the sharp, bright flavors in them. And it turned out, I didn't know who he was at the time, but then he told me. And he said he had bought, bought the recipes of a meadery in Anchorage called maybe Celestial Meads. And he was making two or three of their, Denali Brewing was introducing a line of meads where they were using their recipes. So I know Denali Brewing is making mead. There's something in Anchorage now that I've heard about but haven't been there called Two something or other. Like, but the guy from Denali said he didn't think there was anyone else in the state doing any wild fermentation commercially of meads, or it sounded like of anything else. So I don't think anyone else. I think there's no one else using natural wild fermentation.
Are there any regulations that are specific to meaderies?
We do have those same rules. They apply to wineries. I'm considered a winery as well as breweries. And yeah, we aren't allowed to have live music, can't have TV, can't have games. As I understand it, I'm new to this, but I think there's a really strong historical lobby of very rich bar owners who have these hugely successful bar operations all over the state. And they have lobbied the legislature to make sure that these upstart breweries and wineries won't offer any competition to them. So we have to stop serving alcohol at 8 p.m., can't have live music, can't have games, that kind of thing. Can't have anyone sitting at the bar. That's why you have to stand at the bar if you're ordering, and then you can go sit somewhere else. So yeah, those same rules apply.
You had talked about how you had received training in, was it Sicily or Malta?
Training?
Maybe not training, but...
Where I learned to make wine?
Yeah, the influence of these...
Oh, the natural winemakers. So in Europe, there's a really well-developed movement called the natural wine movement. It's in Italy and France. Those are the two main countries. And they basically make wines the way I make meads, which is there's nothing in there except the fruit. And in my case, the honey and the water. But so they never use sulfites. They don't use commercial yeast. I own a little tiny farmhouse in Sicily with 200 grapevines and some olive trees on it. And my neighbor across the valley is Franco Nellison, and he's one of the pioneers of the natural wine movement. So I got a lot of tips from him on how to, you know, there's ways that you can easily develop off flavors if you use wild yeast and then don't use a bunch of sulfites and sorbates and other preservatives. You know, there's 70 different chemicals that you can legally add to a wine, and you don't have to disclose any of it, except every wine has to say contains sulfites. And that's, again, a lobby. You know, there's this really strong wine vineyard owner, I don't know what, winemaker's lobby. Consumer advocates are always pushing for the dozens of weird animal and fish products and eggs and everything that can go into a wine, artificial coloring, sugar added, water added, all the stuff you can add to a wine legally without disclosing it. And there's a movement of people trying to push to have disclosures so they know what wines have what. But there's like a wall of resistance from the winemakers because they've been doing it that way for so long and they don't want to tell you what's in there.
Is there something that's not great about sulfites? Is that why they have to disclose it?
Yeah, there's a certain percentage of people who have a particular reaction to sulfites that causes them to get a headache or to flush. Not everyone has that, and not all wine headaches are from sulfites. But yeah, at a certain point, the one concession that the wine lobby made was to allow the disclosure of sulfites. But the condition that they imposed was that every single person, whether they add sulfites or not, has to put contains sulfites on their bottle. So you can't find, even if you are a natural winemaker, it will still say contains sulfites on the bottle because that's the law. Everyone, because they say, well, every wine has a trace of sulfites in there. There could be sulfur in the air. There could, certain plants, you know, could have, in the soil, there could be sulfur. So if you want to do this super complicated and expensive process where you ship bottles to the FDA or to a federal agency and have them test it for you at enormous expense, and you have to do it every few months, unless you can prove that you don't have sulfites, which is not feasible to do, you have to put contained sulfites on the bottle. The one exception is agricultural wines that are not made from grapes. So I don't, on my bottles, it doesn't say it contains sulfites because I don't add any chemicals of any kind, certainly not sulfites. So because it's an agricultural wine, it's a non-standard, non-grape wine, then in that case I don't have to because I'm not really competing with those winemakers. So that's the only disclosure that's ever been imposed on winemakers, and it's meaningless because every single wine says that whether they add it or not.
So you don't use sulfites. You say you use water, yeast, honey, and then the berries.
I wouldn't even say yeast because...
Oh, that's right.
It's
wild
just
yeast.
From the air. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the only thing I put into the pot is water, honey, berries or herbs, and a little bit of last week's water, honey, berries and herbs. I've never added anything. I mean, if you measured it, you would find that there was types of yeast and lactobacteria in there, but I'm not adding it. It's just from the environment. I guess the one thing I would say is that because I don't add any sulfites, the only wines that I have that are stable to sit on the shelf are the ones that are completely dry and don't have any sugar left in them, any honey, you know, any sugars from the honey left in them. So, and some of my more popular ones are the fizzy, sparkly ones. So because there's no sorbates and sulfites added to them, they have to be kept in the fridge and treated like kombucha or something like that. And if you left them on the shelf as with kombucha, it would get very, very fizzy. My bottles won't explode because they're champagne bottles with a champagne closure that is rated and that's all rated for 90 psi. So they won't blow up, but they will get so fizzy that you'll lose half the wine when you open it up if you're not careful. So that is just one funny or unusual aspect, outgrowth of the fact that I don't use any sulfites or sorbates.
Sulfites are the preservative.
Yeah, but I know from talking to other winemakers here in town that no matter how much sulfites you add, you'll never get all the yeast. If you have a sweeter wine, which a lot of people do, then the corks will start popping in the following spring, even if you added a ton of sulfites. So after they add all the sulfites to kill 99% of the yeast, then they have to add a whole bunch of potassium sorbate, which is another preservative, to coat the remaining yeast and prevent them from reproducing. So it's kind of it's apparently the industry standard for having a type of a safe, if you want a sweet wine, there's a chemical price to pay in drinking a sweet wine, unless you're willing to keep it in the fridge and have it be a little bit fizzy.
What is a Apfel wine? I saw that on your website.
Say it again.
Apfel?
Apfelwein. Oh, yeah. So, Apfelwein. So, when I got my license to be... Well, first of all, I was going to be just a winery, and I was making berry wines with local ingredients. And since we don't have sugarcane fields here, my local honey sugar source was going to be honey. But the federal government regulates what you can call wines. And if you want to sell a berry wine as raspberry wine or blackcurrant wine, you can only use white sugar. If you use honey, you have to sell it as a mead. So I became a meadery because of that. And then I was kind of surprised to discover, once I got my winery license, that it included the right to make cider. Because in my mind, cider is, I kind of associated with beer, because it's cold and fizzy and 6% alcohol, rather than wine, which is, yeah. But for the government, including the state of Alaska, cider is considered a type of wine. And I was kind of excited because a couple years ago, when I was going back to my place in Sicily, we stopped in Frankfurt in September. And on every corner, every bar, there's a sign that said Apfelwein now in. So I finally, after seeing the 20th sign, we went in and said, what is Apfelwein? Can we have a glass? And what it was is freshly fermented hard cider that's completely dry. Like, they press the apples, they ferment it to dry, and then like a week after the apples were on the tree, they give you this dry, crisp, fizzing, sparkling cider that is completely not sweet. And I loved it. And I wasn't so sure that people would like it if they hadn't acquired a taste for it, because hard cider is almost always sweet here. The way they make hard cider in the U.S. especially is to get a little bit of apple juice, add a ton of water, then add a ton of sugar. And you don't have to disclose any of that. It's just cider. And then it comes out. And then once it's fermented, they add a bunch more sugar to make it sweet. And then they add sulfites and sorbates to it, so that it doesn't keep fermenting to kill all the yeast, and you have this sweet, fizzy cider. So I wasn't sure how popular a dry cider would be. People have loved it. Like, I often offer to sweeten it up with a little bit of honey or honey mead, and they're like, no, it's great. It's so refreshing and crisp and delicious. So I've been surprised. And it's in the Frankfurt area of Germany, that type of cider is called apple wine, which in German is Apfelwein. So thank you for asking.
Is it just, it's really fast ferment because there's not that much sugar?
Yeah, there's something about apples that, yeah, I think it's probably because there's only half the sugar that there is in my other wines, but there's something about the sugar that's in apples that ferments really quickly. You know, I could make a 6% alcohol mead and it would probably take 3 weeks to ferment to dry, but there's something about apples where it just goes from very sweet to completely dry within 5 days. And it's delicious. And you can just smell the appleness of it. When you take the same wine, like I made 40 kegs of that, so 200 gallons of that last fall, and put them in my storage room, cool, and brought out a keg a week or so over the course of the fall and the winter. By January, February, it's still a delicious drink, but you don't get those fresh apple notes that like biting into a really crisp apple at all. You just get a nice, dry, refreshing cider, but without the fresh fruit notes. Those kind of fade over time, which is, I guess, why it's a seasonal thing. Frankfurt.
So yesterday was my first time ever coming to the meadery.
Oh, welcome.
The mead is amazing. The atmosphere is amazing too, which atmosphere goes a long way, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah, there was some oysters.
Yeah,
oyster
there's a food truck here where she sells oysters. Yeah.
Are you open year round?
Yes.
And what are the hours and where are you located?
Okay, I'm on Main Street. You could say between Napa Auto Parts on the bypass road and the Homer Theater on Pioneer. I'm in between those two, just right below Brian's Appliance. Yeah, on the same side of the street. And my hours, so far since I opened, it's always been 2 to 7, 7 days a week. And on weekends, I open an hour early, so it's 1 to 7. But 2 to 7 is easy to remember. In the fall, I might go down. I might close Monday, Tuesday. I think it would be nice to have a weekend once I've been open for a year. October 1st will be my one-year anniversary, and I'm thinking that after that, I might go down to 5 days a week for the winter and then open up 7 days a week again in the summer. But to be determined. Actually, when I first opened up, I was closed Mondays. But then I found that I was always here working anyway and making wine and stuff. And then people would stop by not knowing, and I would serve them. After a while, I was like, well, why should I be closed if I'm here anyway? So, but I think I will try to take an actual weekend starting in my second year.
Do you usually spend your day in the morning making the wine?
Now in the summer, because I have someone helping me behind the bar, I have two women, Danielle and Sarah, that do most of the serving. I've been able to do almost all the winemaking during the open hours, and because I kind of like to be around to help with the flow and step in if it gets too busy. So there was a period where I got a little bit behind and I was coming in at 6 a.m. and working for 2 hours and I got caught up really quick. But in general, I've been able to do the winemaking during working hours. But when I'm on my own in the winter, it's a little bit harder to switch back and forth between serving and making because it's a process.
Yeah, before the interview, I was told that you could be found normally sitting with the patrons and chatting, and when I came here, that's exactly what I saw. And I really like that. It's a nice when an owner of an establishment is approachable.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we lived in France for a couple of years and in Sicily before we came here, and it seems like a European way where the owner likes to be around talking to the regulars, meeting some of the new people. So I do. It's a little bit harder when I'm alone, but when I have someone else behind the bar, it's really, and I'm caught up on my winemaking, it's fun and nice to be able to get to know the customers a little bit.
Well, thank you so much. Anything?
Thank you, Desiree.
Anything else?
I don't think so.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And that was Jason Davis of Sweet Gale Meadworks and Cider House, recorded July 29th, 2021. That's the show. I want to thank Lewis Maurer of Bear Creek Winery and Jason Davis of Sweet Gale Meadworks and Cider House for chatting with me. Local musicians Carly Konimak and Kevin Cope for our intro music. Brian Black and the band Trial and Terror. You can find both of their music on Bandcamp. Ryan is under Glacier Maximus and Trial and Terror under that name. Questions, comments, and conversations about theoretical physics can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.